This is the thing that I think is going to be the hardest for Asian Americans, in a way, is that we've internalized the market success mentality so deeply. Now, I spent years training entrepreneurs to try and become successful in the market, really. And it's beautiful work. It's very wholesome. I'm very proud of it. But, you know, like, the truth is, like, the market will have no solutions for us on this one.
Hi, everyone. This is Rock the Boat, a podcast about Asian Americans charting unconventional career paths. Whether you're an entrepreneur, creative, or someone who's looking to break through a few ceilings, this podcast was made for you. We're your hosts, Lucia Liu and Lynn Gui.
Hi, everyone. It's Lynn, and welcome to episode 9 of Rock the Boat. Just a quick reminder, we have only 2 more episodes after this one before we officially conclude the season. Lucia and I will break for about a month, but we'll be back in May for season 2. If you're on our email list, you may have received a short survey. We would really appreciate your feedback to help us make the next season more relevant, engaging, and hopefully worth your time. You can find the link in the show notes, and if you so choose, you can even send us some of your comments as a voice memo. Just open the voice memo app on your phone, hit record, and then email the audio file to us at hello@gorocktheboat.com. Your comment may be included in our last episode, so you might get the chance to hear your voice on air. We can't wait to hear from you. Now, on with the show. There's been a lot of talk about the next presidential election, even though it's over a year and a half away. I think at last count, within the Democratic Party, there are at least a dozen candidates who are officially in the race, and that field is growing by the day. Today, we're really excited to share a conversation we had with arguably one of the most unique candidates to enter the race, Andrew Yang. Full disclosure, I worked for Andrew at Venture for America, which is the entrepreneurship fellowship program he started back in 2011 to help revitalize economically struggling cities. So I may be a little biased, but I think by any objective measure, Andrew stands out amid the very crowded field of presidential candidates. For one, he's not a seasoned politician. He's actually a serial entrepreneur who is more known for starting and leading companies than waging political battles. Andrew's also running on a rather unconventional policy platform that proposes universal basic income. And last, but certainly not least, he's Asian American, which will make him the first Asian American to ever run for president of the United States as a Democrat. For the record, the first Asian American to run for president was Hiram Fong, a senator from Hawaii who ran for the Republican Party presidential nomination in 1964. He was also the first Asian American U.S. senator. Andrew says on his website that being the first Asian American president is not his motivation for running, but I think the mere act of running is pretty game-changing. At the very least, it's opening a dialogue about the future of humanity and the role Asian Americans should play in civic life, politics, and broader society. In this episode, we talk to Andrew about his upbringing, his brief stint as a corporate lawyer, which then led him into a career of entrepreneurship, his thoughts on Asian American civic involvement, why he's running for president, and ultimately, why we all need to wake up to the economic realities of our time. Andrew will also serve up a brief primer on his campaign platform, so get your notepads ready.
I'm Andrew Yang. I'm running for president as a Democrat in 2020 on a platform that technology is transforming our society and that we need to evolve very quickly to think about work and value more broadly.
We met Andrew at his campaign headquarters in New York City, a humble office in the Garment District, decorated with campaign placards, a loose hanging basketball hoop, and an assortment of flyers on the wall, one of which simply said math.
So I was born in Schenectady, New York. My parents immigrated from Taiwan in the 60s, and then they met in graduate.
Like many Asian American immigrants at the time, Andrew's parents came to the United States for academic reasons. His parents met in grad school, and his father went on to work at IBM, generating 69 patents over the course of his career. Andrew spent his high school years at Phillips Exeter Academy, one of America's most elite boarding schools.
I was a very nerdy kid when I was growing up. feel like there was like a sort of a monoculture, certainly where I was, and that we all, at least I was just trying to conform to a particular way of being, as a boy in particular. I remember vividly just feeling like such like this misfit, and just remembering I will always remember this and want to try and look out for whoever is the underdog.
Andrew may have never forgotten this sense of marginalization, but he writes in his book, The War on Normal People, which was released last year, that he thinks many people do. Specifically, he's referring to a sect of Asian Americans who end up channeling their energy towards working hard and going on to become successful by the standard definition, which isn't a bad thing at all, but in the process, they forget about their own isolating, marginalized history.
Instead of embracing that sense of marginalization, I think most of us embrace like a sense of success or accepting, which does not involve typically making a lot of fuss about like circumstances you experienced years ago. If we all did remember that, then we'd be much more aligned with whoever is marginalized by race or gender, circumstance, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status. But most Asians don't act like we care about any of that stuff. We just sort of get to a certain point and we build our lives and we just forget the alienness.
You'll hear elements of this theme of rooting for the underdog throughout Andrew's career, but early on his path would seem quite conventional. He did well in school, checked all the boxes on the ladder of achievement, and didn't really think much of it.
My calculation was pretty simple, where my dad has a PhD in physics, my mom has a master's in math, and my brother was getting a PhD. So I was like, oh, I should go to graduate school. It's like, which one? It's like, well, which one can you do straight out of college? That seems like very straightforward. It's like, oh, law school. And then I took the LSAT and did very well. And so it's like, all right, it wasn't very sophisticated, which was not unusual in that era. Most of the people I went to Columbia with the law school, like no one knew what they were doing there. We're all sort of there.
So Andrew continued to go through the motions, following a well-trodden path where success was quote-unquote assured.
You're good at school. School's not terrible. So you're like, all right, this is fine. It's only when you're good at school and it leads you to a terrible job did I be like, holy crap, this path leads nowhere.
And then the hard truth began to sink in.
Like everything changed when I showed up and I got the law firm job I wanted. I was like a corporate associate at Davis Polk & Wardwell, which was like the firm that I targeted, and it was just such a miserable job. And I was like, so this is the job that being good at school gets you, and it's terrible. And so then I said, okay, there needs to be a different path towards something better. So I joke with people all the time that what motivated me was just being a corporate attorney for 5 months and seeing just how terrible it was. So I was the first in my class to leave. And, you know, I guess I could have done what, like, most Asian Americans would do in that situation, which is, okay, I guess I'll stay at Davis Polk for 2 years, and I'll try and find another job, move in-house. And I just didn't have the stomach for that. So I left to start a dot-com that crashed and burned, which then led to a lot of other things.
That .com was a celebrity-affiliated fundraising site called StarGiving.com, which was then followed by a brief stint at another startup that ran out of money. Those early failures were admittedly difficult days, but they were instrumental in teaching Andrew how to build a business.
Starting that business was an incredible education because I was like a 25-year-old lawyer. I didn't know what I was doing, but just ran around and hustled it up. So after my startup dies, I lose people $250,000 or so. Still owe $100,000 in law school debt. So at this point, I was like the very unsuccessful Asian American. It's like 26, net worth of negative $100,000. My parents are like lying to people and telling them I'm still a lawyer, like just like living in a friend's place.
After his second failed startup, Andrew went on to work at a healthcare startup called MMF Systems, where he learned from more experienced entrepreneurs. And on the side, he started throwing parties and turned it into a side gig.
It actually was pretty cool during that era where I could go to any one of like, you know, a bunch of lounges downtown and they'd just give me the like VIP treatment because like, you know, I'd bring them thousands of dollars and moderately heavy drinking Asians. So I was doing that and then I was teaching the GMAT because my friend started this GMAT prep company, which also ended up being like a very important step in my career.
This GMAT prep company was called Manhattan Prep. And it went on to become the number one test prep company in the country. Manhattan Prep put a huge emphasis on teaching, hiring only the best teachers and paying them very well, which turned out to be an excellent strategy. Andrew started out as a teacher and was later asked by the founder, Zeke Vanderhook, to take over as CEO. In 2009, the company was acquired by Kaplan.
Those were like the glory days, but it took a long time to get there. I mean, between the time I left the law firm and then joined Manhattan Prep, it was, I think, about 6 or 7 years.
While Andrew was CEO at Manhattan Prep, he personally taught the analyst classes for its high-end corporate clients like Goldman Sachs, McKinsey, and JP Morgan. And it was in these classes that he began to notice a growing talent gap.
So imagine, again, teaching the analyst classes at Goldman Sachs, McKinsey, and seeing all these unhappy kids who are just like, hey, like, don't like my job, taking the GMAT, go back to business school, take out 100K in loans so I can find my passion or purpose. And I was like, oh, what a train wreck. And so during this time, it was like the financial crisis too. And I was like, man, like, we need to get our talented people out of all becoming bankers, consultants, lawyers, doctors, or coders, and hopefully doing something like Zeke did or I did, where like you end up building a company that creates jobs.
Witnessing this trend, Andrew decided to start something new. He left Manhattan Prep and poured some of his personal savings into Venture for America, a national entrepreneurship fellowship program that sends talented university graduates to cities in need of an economic boost, cities like Baltimore, Detroit, and New Orleans. Their mission at the time was to create 100,000 jobs by 2025. It was a lofty goal, but it inspired many, including myself. I joined the team as employee number 5. In the early days, we worked out of the Manhattan Prep office and would personally email every single Venture for America prospect.
That was a real trip looking at it, because I would go places and like go to, that fall I went to Cornell and Vanderbilt and like every other school I could get like an info session with. And I'd go, and there'd be, like, nobody there, because, like, no one ever heard of Venture for America, and it's just, like, me there hanging out. So I'd go sometimes, and there'd be, like, 2 kids there. Like, I went without salary, too, in the early days, because I was trying to stretch the resource. I mean, we didn't really have any meaningful resources.
Andrew crafted a credo that, to this day, every Venture for America fellow signs. It states, "My career is a choice that indicates my values. There is no courage without risk. I believe that actions are the proper measure of one's accomplishments. I will create value for myself and others. I will act with integrity in all things."
I just really, really believed in Venture for America to the point where it overrode any potential reservations I'd have about asking people for money or help or whatnot.
Today, Venture for America is a multi-million dollar organization that has helped create over 2,500 jobs around the country. Venture for America alums have gone on to start dozens of companies that have raised over $40 million and counting. So by most metrics, the organization has fostered a thriving entrepreneurial environment in many struggling cities. But in 2017, Andrew began to notice an alarming trend as he traveled across the Midwest. He noticed a growing discontent among working-class Americans that he just couldn't shake. With Venture for America steadily growing and in good hands, he handed over the reins and left the organization to tackle a new set of problems.
Imagine spending 7 years helping hundreds of entrepreneurs in Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis, Birmingham, Baltimore, all these cities, creating several thousand jobs in those communities, and then getting awards from the White House, and like a movie gets made about you and your organization. And then you have this sinking feeling that develops and festers more and more, that you're pouring water into a bathtub that has a giant hole ripped in the bottom, that your efforts are futile, that millions of jobs are being lost, and if you create like 100 jobs, it's awesome, but like in the scheme of things, it's not going to stop the tide.
That tide is the rise of workplace automation and the wave of jobs it will eventually displace. He says that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in swing states like Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Iowa, leading to Donald Trump's election. And we're about to do the same thing for more jobs.
And then you go to the political establishment and say, hey guys, we're in the third inning of the greatest economic and technological transformation in the history of the world. And it's going to get much, much faster very quickly, because we're going to automate the retail jobs, the call center jobs, the fast food jobs, the truck driving jobs. By the time we're done, this place is going to be unrecognizable. And then what you get from them is like this total sort of blankness, where it's like you're speaking another language, because you're talking about facts and figures, and no one in politics cares about anything other than words, ideas, feelings, and fundraising.
If you want to talk facts and figures, Andrew has them.
When I did research for my book, like, I found, you know, 57% of Americans can't afford an unexpected $500 bill, which is something that for most of us listening to this are like, that's crazy. So the average net worth in this country is about $38,000, only $6,000 if you exclude home and vehicle equity. This country's wealth disparities are literally among the worst in the history of the world.
On the campaign trail, Andrew often makes the joke that what the country needs more than ever is the opposite of Donald Trump, aka an Asian American like him who is good at math.
This country needs an Asian American perspective, insofar as that perspective might actually lead them to recognize the reality of the situation we're in. So it's not immigrants, it's not globalization even, it's not just like a massive surge in racism out of nowhere. Like, it's the fact that our economy is being transformed for good. And so that's the set of ideas that possessed me in 2017 after Trump won. And I was like, you know, coming back from these meetings being like, what are we going to do? Like, this country is really fucked.
To adapt to this new future, Andrew is proposing what he calls the freedom dividend. The freedom dividend is a form of universal basic income, which would provide all Americans between the ages of 18 and 64 with $1,000 per month. He's convinced that actual financial resources in the hands of people is the only solution to fend the impending technological apocalypse.
You say to someone like, hey, we're going to automate away hundreds of thousands of truck driving jobs. They're like 3.5 million truckers. Average age, 49, 94% male, average education, high school. And then the knee-jerk reaction, because we're so conditioned that everyone needs to have a place in the market, it's like, oh, we have to retrain those truckers. We have to retrain those truckers as, and then the biggest fantasy is like, turn them all into coders. Just like we turn the miners into coders, you know, or like whatever like the ridiculous notion of the day is.
Andrew's main message is that very few jobs will be immune from the relentless advance of automation. This includes factory and retail workers, in addition to many well-paid white-collar jobs that were once assumed to be a safe bet, like wealth managers and lawyers.
This is the thing that I think is going to be the hardest for Asian Americans, in a way, is that we've internalized the market success mentality so deeply. Now, I spent years training entrepreneurs to try and become successful in the market, really. And it's beautiful work. It's very wholesome. I'm very proud of it. But, you know, like, the truth is, like, the market will have no solutions for us on this one. Like, we really are going to need to evolve.
Andrew is still an ardent believer in capitalism. He just believes we need an updated form of it, centered around humans.
So the plan is to evolve in terms of the way we see both work and value, and put $1,000 a month in the hands of every American adult. So if you're listening to this, doesn't matter what your job situation is or anything, you're going to get $1,000 a month. And what this would do is it would create several million jobs. It would make families and communities stronger, would improve people's mental health, physical health, would help people actually move, retrain, even start new businesses in some circumstances. It would bolster the Main Street economies. It would take us from a mindset of scarcity, which is where most of America is, and move us towards a mindset of abundance and relative optimism.
Well, Andrew has 72 other proposals for his platform outlined on his campaign website, yang2020.com. His primary focus is on the future of work, because as he sees it, nearly all other issues will stem from this impending crisis.
I was with a couple of guys yesterday who cared deeply about climate change. And what I suggested to them was like, look, the average American right now is so focused on their week-to-week and month-to-month survival that they just do not care about climate change. It's only after you get their head up and you secure their future that they'll say, yeah, that really is a problem. Like, you know, my kid is going to have to live on this planet too. So the way we reverse this mindset is through actual resources in people's hands. There's no other way to do it.
Which brings up a rather profound question. Where will we find our worth in the future when fewer of us are working and deriving less value from the market?
I did not intend for it to get that philosophical, but as soon as you start pressing on it, you realize that's where we have to go. Because the market, like AI, can outperform a radiologist just like it can a taxi driver. And so that radiologist might have spent like 10, 12 years in like schools, like getting really good at reading films. So we need to get much more human much more quickly, because this set of measurements will kill us.
It's tempting to listen to this doomsday message and then turn back to our life of modern amenities. I too wonder how serious this threat of automation is. But ultimately, regardless of how it affects my job prospects, I think it boils down to the simple truth that nothing is ever assured, and that it's always in our own self-interest to pay attention to these broader societal trends, like rising inequality, automation, and displacement, even if it doesn't affect our current day-to-day, because you never know when it will.
You know, mass shooting in a synagogue, what, like a month ago in Pittsburgh? And like what I said to a group of Asian Americans, it's like, we're like one generation away from that happening to us. Like, if we don't get our shit together. And if you look around and you're like, oh, like, I'm all right. Like, I'm getting my Amazon deliveries or whatever. It's like, yeah, you're going to be all right until you're not all right. I'm not running for president because I'm Asian. I want to do this thing for Asians. Like, I'm running for president because I can see very clearly which way this country is going. And also that none of the current politicians have a deep enough understanding of what the causes are.
It's worth noting here that to date, Asian Americans have been somewhat of a non-factor in politics. We don't have the numbers at just under 6% of the population and are too spread out across different subgroups with no major alignment to a specific political party. But politicians also haven't paid much attention because we aren't usually the first to show up in civic life.
I do believe that my campaign can have immensely positive effects in terms of the way that Asian Americans get perceived, where they see that we actually are willing to define our self-interest a little bit more broadly. And to me, it's enlightened self-interest anyway. It's like, you know, it doesn't take much of a leap to see how this is going to be very important for our community. We're in a very unique place, and I think we need to become like the lever or the glue, because the dynamics between the different races are such that, like, I think Asians end up being like sort of the most white friendly, or like pass into certain environments and then we almost like disappear. What I found happening to me and also to most of the people I resemble that is like, you don't really have like a fixed sense of consciousness or righteousness about any of that stuff. You end up just doing a job and living your life. Like the alienness that you felt, you know, it's sort of easy just to forget about it, because now you're hanging out with a whole battalion of Asian American yuppies, like in your enclave, and you know, and then like there's like not that sense of struggle.
So how can we show up? How can we command attention to the issues that matter to us? And how can we be stronger allies to other marginalized groups? Here's what Andrew thinks.
Outside of my campaign, which again I would love for you to support, you know, I think Asian Americans need to put our money where our mouth is, where, like, frankly, we have more money than most other Americans, where if you look at our economic success, like, we have as much money as white people in terms of the average and higher education levels on average. But we have, like, a degree of insecurity that makes us somewhat stingy. So we need to start putting our money where our mouth is in terms of demonstrating our values. So the values could be something like, hey, I'm going to buy from Asian American businesses. I mean, that would be something. You know, it could be like, hey, I'm going to donate to Asian American organizations, also something. But it could also be like, hey, I'm going to donate to an organization that like helps poor people in this community. And like, most of them are not Asian, but it's cool.
Of course, it goes without saying that you should exercise your civic right and vote. If Andrew's message speaks to you, here's how you can help.
Tell your friends, hey, there's an Asian American running for president, and he makes a lot of sense. So you can just Google Andrew Yang, or the website's yang2020.com. And I think that 2020 is the perfect opportunity. One, because, you know, you're the first Asian American guy running for president as a Democrat in history, but also that California moved up its primary voting schedule so that it's going to vote fifth after South Carolina. Earliest California has voted, I think, certainly in decades. And so Asian Americans might actually have a chance to choose who's going to be the nominee for president.
You hear that, Callie? Since our interview last December, Andrew's campaign has gained momentum. He tweeted the other day that February was his best month yet, raising nearly $600,000, which is a personal record for his campaign. He's also been traversing the country and building a grassroots support network. And recent appearances on the Joe Rogan podcast, Fox News, and other major news outlets continue to give him more exposure.
You know, now I'm running for president, so like it's less about this idea for a company than it is my campaign. But my campaign is similar in that my campaign is built on ideas that I feel very, very strongly about that I think transcend me truly, and that if they were to get implemented and adopted and I were not to become president, I would be still incredibly proud and excited.
Thank you, Andrew, for raising awareness about the effects of automation, motivating our community to take action, and galvanizing America. For those of you who are inspired to help, Andrew's biggest focus these days is getting enough individual donors to make it to the Democratic debates. He needs 65,000 individual people to donate by May 15th. So the best way you can help is by making a donation on his website, yang2020.com. If you want to learn more or get involved, we've included relevant links to Andrew's campaign in the show notes. Next time on Rock the Boat.
After I had graduated, there wasn't very much work to be done, actually. And my 22nd birthday ended up coinciding with the Haiti earthquake. And that was when I decided to go and busk at a New York subway stop to raise money and sing for Haiti. And that was really what set off this whole journey that became Jubilee.
We speak with Jason Y. Lee, the founder of Jubilee Media, a media company with 2.5 million YouTube subscribers built for positive, purpose-driven millennials. We speak with Jason about what it means to live a life true to yourself and not what others expected of you, working for the Obama presidential campaign and how it inspired him, pursuing his childhood dream of storytelling, the challenges he faced while building Jubilee Media, and his aspirations for creating the next wave of change makers. Stay tuned. The best way to get notified of new episodes is to subscribe on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. If you liked what you heard, please share this episode with anyone you think could benefit from it. And leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Those positive reviews help a ton. Lucy Huang mixed and edited today's episode. Lucy has been doing ballet for 11 years and went on point, which is a classical ballet technique where the dancer supports all her body weight on the tips of fully extended feet, when she was 18. She definitely busted the myth that you can't start ballet later in life. Again, just a reminder to fill out our mid-season survey. We've provided a link for it in the show notes. Your feedback is really important to us. We read all of it, I promise. And it's the best way for us to improve this podcast. So we really appreciate any type of advice or feedback that you can give. If you send us a voice memo, you might hear it in the last episode of our season. Finally, we're heading out west at the end of March, so if you're in LA or SF, give us a shout. We're looking for folks with a fresh perspective or story in media, entertainment, or tech industries. Email us at hello@gorocktheboat.com if you have a suggestion for a guest for season 2 or season 3. That's hello@gorocktheboat.com. All right, see you guys next time.